Hi everyone, it's Daniel here at False Summits, exploring the how and the why of overcoming challenges and using values as a guide in career, education, creativity, and adventure. Welcome to the first episode of the False Summits podcast. This episode is about the following question. Why do we learn by overcoming challenges? Is there a sense even in which we should learn this way? There's something really compelling and invigorating about this. If I think about it, I'm presented with challenges or problems every day, so there's always an opportunity to get that little bit better. I fail to get up in the morning when I want to, say 6 a.m, and I stay in bed till 7. Well, alright then, I think I better be hitting that target the next day, and then I don't. But at least I get up at 6:30 instead. Self-discipline just got a tiny bit better. There you go, overcoming challenges. In this episode, I'm going to tackle this question from a few different angles and give you some stories and useful questions along the way that can help us all learn more effectively and be that bit more resilient. Let's get to it. I'm going to start things off with a story of overcoming a mountain, literally. I visited South Korea, a very mountainous country, in May 2019 for the second time. When I went the first time, I had heard that the Korean Peninsula was renowned for its mountains, and that the people enjoyed getting outdoors just as much as they enjoyed whipping the rest of the world in esports at League of Legends from their high-speed Wi-Fi internet cafes. The first time, I only stayed near Seoul, so this time I was determined to explore the countryside. Now, in the countryside, there is a huge mountain range that spines the entire peninsula. It's called the Baekdu Daegun mountain range. It's a chain of mountains from which the Korean people have drawn spiritual nourishment for thousands of years. And at the bottom of the country, the mountain range terminates at a mountain called Jirisan, one of the most challenging climbs in the whole range. I'm not going to pretend that I actually surmounted that peak, Jirisan. It takes 3 days and probably a team of hikers, and I had neither of those. So I contented myself with a 5-hour trail that crossed over one of the mountain ridges. So one of those ridges that pointed up towards the mountain. And this trail joined a Son Zen Buddhist temple called Sangyasa, and an ancient Taoist palace, Samseong-gun. The only day I had to do this hike was the only day that rain was forecast in my trip, and I thought, what the heck, I can always turn back if I want to. Besides, when I arrived at Sangyasa, there was only a light mist falling. It's not threatening. So I set out, and the Koreans love their mountains, right? So surely there would be at least 10 people out here, even on a day like this, right? In the first 3 hours, I saw only one human being. I was never entirely sure that the path I was on even existed. My internet searches and a Korean friend both could not find it on the National Park's website or anywhere else. But the Korean map app had a skinny brown line joining the two historical sites that I was hiking between, so it should exist. Fortunately, as I mentioned before, the Wi-Fi in South Korea is phenomenal, and I could see how far I had progressed along the trail as I was walking, and this light mist turned into a rain, and rain started to come down. But I was warm from the exercise, and I thought if only I could scale that ridge, everything would be downhill on the way to the second site. Easy. It would be much more satisfying than turning back before halfway. And it didn't matter so much that it seemed nobody was out here. I think this was something of a point of pride, looking back. So I kept raising one foot above the other, brushing through hordes of ferns and wooden bridges slick with rain. To motivate myself to get through, I thought of two of my friends who had completed hikes that stretched for more than 4 days, some of them in a lot of rain as well. And I thought, if they could get through that, I could get through this. And then I reached the peak of that ridge, and I saw that blessed sign that said, Samseong-gun, this way, great. It would be all downhill from here, but little did I know that there was a different problem around the corner. So, the path certainly was downhill. But that wasn't the hard part. Instead, it was losing the path. The rain began to pour, which formed many different rushing streams, and normally the path across a stream is easy to tell because the water is still or it's not that high, but now they all just looked pretty much the same, and the rocks that were segmenting them were sharp and wet and too far between for you to jump across them. And in between the streams were piles of stone with layers of sodden brush and leaves in between, like creating this illusion of stability. It looked almost like a rock or that you could step on. Once or twice, my foot would scramble for one of these patches and fall almost knee-deep in damp leaves, almost twisting my ankle. And I kept reminding myself, keep a cool head. If I panicked, I would struggle even more to recover the path. Or I would make an unsafe judgment. So I took deep breaths and I kind of figured out where the path should be, even when the maps on my phone led me astray. So in this downpour, I concluded that some of the branches would be rotting and so they wouldn't really provide a sturdy grip. So I remember scanning a stream for a safe way to cross. You know, you can just hear all this like loud rushing water in the background. And I selected the tree that would be my support, you know, thinking, you know, grab the one that's not sodden and rotten. And I wrapped my wrist around it and tried to swing over the gap. But my arm gave way as the tree, rotting and sodden, came loose. And I'm sure it would have made a crack or a groan, but I couldn't hear it in all the rain. And I felt that whoosh of falling backwards that would have landed me in the gushing water. But at the same time, my other arm sprang into action and grasped a nearby branch. So thank you, rapid evolutionary instincts. Eventually, so I'm standing on the other bank and I'm almost berating myself for my stupidity. You know, I could have landed on a jagged rock or been swept further down or lost the phone that, you know, despite its periodic lapses in navigation, it was actually proving invaluable. I realized too that I couldn't get too angry or think of what my family would say. So even though I'm kind of telling myself off, I'm like, stop it. I had one task only, and getting frustrated or sentimental, thinking too much about people at home, would only stop my progress, halt my progress. Eventually, I kept progressing downhill, and then I made out the site of the palace ruins that I was making my way towards. Still on the other side of this roaring river, but a final few jumps, and I made it across a bedraggled mess of a Westerner, gratefully nodding at the bemused old Korean tourists, you know, and they're decked out in their ponchos and umbrellas, wandering the ruins like, who's this guy? Oh, but I was grateful. Never so grateful to see a human. This journey was certainly reckless. I won't be climbing any mountains alone in such circumstances again, but it did teach me some important lessons about resilience and learning that I'm going to jump into this episode. So, while I started this episode with a story of a literal mountain, a physical challenge, there are, of course, many other challenges in life, and we face them all the time, even these small interior battles that we contend with things within our own minds, our own emotions. So I encourage you, as you listen through here, to think of some of the challenges that you faced in your life. Or think of something right now that you want to learn, or something that you need to learn. What stands in the way of you and your goal? Maybe it's wanting to take up a class of something, dance or coding or art, or maybe it's a sport or a better gym routine. It might be trying to transform a negative habit or thought pattern into an edifying alternative. The obstacles of doubt or time management or imposter syndrome could be making themselves known here. So note them, welcome them into your house. They're your guests, but you are the master. What we're going to do now is go through two perspectives on why learning through challenges is especially rewarding. They are, these two perspectives, they are, in short, the brain and the book. Brain section that we're going to go through deals with some ideas drawn from psychology and neuroscience, while the book section looks through the lens of mythology and literature. First off, the brain section. In my studies and practice of education, I've dabbled in some psychological and neuroscientific models of learning. One model that I love is that by James Nottingham. So he's a professor of education. He invented this concept of the learning pit. Now, it's actually not the best sounding phrase. At first, it makes me think of a mosh pit of jostling, sweaty people, or a pit of snakes or insects that you might find in a film, you know, Indiana Jones style. But he is not proposing that we throw students, you know, or ourselves into a pit of problems that are far beyond our capability and terrifying or just disgusting. We need to be able to get in the pit, but we also need to be able to come out on the other side a little bit higher than the cliff that we clambered down. So it's ultimately a positive experience. That is to say, come out a little bit more skilled or with a little bit more knowledge whenever we encounter a problem. So the pit symbolizing some kind of problem. So James Nottingham believes that when there's a certain concept that we need to learn, we need to undergo a cognitive conflict to really grapple with it and understand it better. So when there's a clash of ideas, it rattles our preconceived notions and it forces us to reflect on our own position. That's that conflict, the cognitive conflict, cognitive inside the mind. This is the stage when we start sliding into the pit. So when you're standing up on the cliff, you're contemplating some kind of concept that you need to learn. And then, whoa, cognitive conflict, there's an issue. Hang on, this thing doesn't make sense. You start to slide into the pit, but you can't quite see the other side. Let's use a little bit of a story or an example to flesh out our understanding of this. Joining us today, we're going to have Raimundo. I have invented him, and he's a student, but some of the strategies that he's using to get through his work, we can also apply in many different situations. So if we're about to use Raimundo as our example and hurl him into the learning pit, let's first of all consider that the concept that he's going to want to develop more knowledge about, it has to do with concentrating a bit more deeply and working a little bit more efficiently. Now, in terms of the learning pit as a symbol for how you grow in resilience and learning, the concept fits at the very start of this symbol. It's when you're standing on the cliff, about to go through the conflict. The conflict for Raimundo is going to have to do with his love of music, particularly his love of music with deep bass sounds that he always uses when he plugs his Apple EarPods in at the beginning of a study session, plugs those in, and thinks that he can concentrate very effectively. It doesn't matter what the subject matter is or how loud the music is, but little does he know things aren't exactly as they seem, and he's about to go sliding down that pit. Raimundo has always assumed that to study better with more concentration, you just need to put in more hours. It doesn't really matter whether you're listening to music or not. It doesn't really matter if you're multitasking, if Instagram is beeping away there, or if you're getting some other notification from your phone, computer. It doesn't matter. If you've got the music, you can concentrate. All right, it's time for Raimundo to come falling down the pit in a cognitive conflict. What's going to bring on this event? It's going to be a discussion that he has with an older cousin. Now, this older cousin sees Raimundo working one day with the earpods in, calls him over, can't get through. Obviously, the music must be too loud. You know, all these things are going on the screen. And the cousin thinks, hang on a second, just how much is he concentrating here? So we pull out one of the Apple earpods, and he has a little chat with him. He gives Raimundo a little bit of a lesson on neuroscience, so brain science. And he tells him that a lot of learning happens when the neurons in the brain cells, when they fire between each other and create electrical signals and patterns between them, that's where learning occurs. How quickly these neurons can fire and communicate information to each other in these patterns. And Raimundo says, you know, I'm just studying English here. You know, I'm not doing brain science. Why are you telling me this? But it's really important because if you're multitasking and switching between different things, what actually happens is that those neurons in your brain, they don't actually fire as quickly. The reason for this is that there is a chemical that coats these cells called myelin, and the more that you're switching between tasks, the less that this chemical builds up around the cells. And you actually want a lot of this chemical because it helps it to fire very smoothly and rapidly, and then you create these patterns, neuron patterns in the brain, very quickly and very efficiently. And it helps you to remember content better, remember concepts better, and to stay on task for longer periods of time. The longer you can stay on a task, the more deeply you will learn about something. A quick note, these insights about myelin and neurological foundations for deliberate practice or deep work in which you're dedicated to a specific task, a lot of this I learnt from Cal Newport's book, Deep Work, and he synthesizes the work of some different psychologists, including Erickson and the author Daniel Coyle. Here comes the cognitive conflict, or perhaps it's already been beginning, sliding into the pit, you know, he's listening to what his cousin has to say, and Raimundo is confused, you know, but what about the bass? I love the bass. Surely the music helps me to study, you know? It's not distracting me, you know, helping me to multitask, get distracted by other things, Instagram, whatever, you know, the bass always brings me back. And so surely the music helps to study, you know, he feels unproductive without it. And isn't he anyway, isn't he just a digital native that can multitask with computers so well because he always grew up with computers, easy, you know, only grandma should be confused, not him. So while the conflict brings us sliding down to the bottom of the pit in confusion, we then look up at how we're supposed to scale the other side and resolve this situation, resolve this problem. So through more research and reflection, we construct some kind of ladder, some other support that helps us climb out of the pit. Often, in order to do this, we actually need other people. This could be in the form of direct collaboration through which we can challenge other people's ideas, refine our own ideas in real time. However, different perspectives, they don't always need to be in the room with us to collaborate with us, you know? You could be reading a book, watching a video, following a forum thread, you know, posting something in a forum thread, getting responses, you know, or a chat with someone that you know. For example, these can all provide alternate points of view that help you to construct your ladder to get out of the pit. Of course, you always need to be careful about your source as well and cross-check them. So it's never helpful just to get one person to help you or to do everything just yourself, depending on the task. So we return to the case of Raimundo resolving the cognitive conflict, climbing out of the pit. For him, it may mean researching which kinds of music promote concentration for which kinds of tasks. So he could call on his friend Vanessa. She's renowned for her vigilant study habits. You know, she's always on point. And she recommends an article from The Conversation on just this issue. I'll attach it in the show notes, actually. And Raimundo discovers that music can be beneficial for studying and solving problems, you know, deep intellectual problems or otherwise any other kinds of problems, so long as it promotes a positive mood and doesn't actually create distraction. Say, for example, like if you're listening to a catchy rap song that makes you just want to stand on your desk in a virtuoso lip-syncing performance, that's always going to distract you. Okay. Now, Raimundo also checks in with the older cousin who puts him onto the book that I mentioned earlier, Deep Work by Cal Newport. Piecing these sources together, Raimundo attempts to keep track of how many times he's distracted by social media, when he's listening to different kinds of music, and when listening to no music at all. Now, he needs to keep the task the same, the task that he might be working on. For example, it could be reading, and that way he can easily compare the results, you know, the different effects that different kinds of music could have on his reading. That way he'll be able to understand what the cause is. Now, I am no Raimundo, but I'd hazard a guess that the bass probably performed better than a rap, and silence may have performed better, but then again, maybe it leads to too many bubbling, distracting thoughts in some people, or maybe it creates a kind of hypersensitivity to the, you know, scraping of chairs or the coughs of other students, and you just want to tune that out, some nice deep bass. So, all these different collaboration, that was Raimundo building his ladder, climbing out of the pit. Finally, we exit the pit, and we look back at that whole slog that we just performed. And this is when we consider what worked, what didn't work. We develop skills in something called metacognition, or thinking about thinking. Cognition, thinking, meta, above or beyond. Essentially, we discover which thought patterns or problem-solving strategies we can add to our repertoire that worked in this case and that may serve us once again. So these are literally brain structures inside the head, ways of thinking, you know, different patterns, twin cells. And so, for example, it could be combining sources of information, turning to reliable sources, or conducting an experiment. A thought pattern that I've adopted from my ordeal in the mountains was keeping my cool, right, and focusing on only one step at a time. And when you face a similar problem again, there will inevitably be confusion, but you'll just feel that little bit more armed and ready, and get that bit better at surmounting these problems. One of the reasons why problems seem to really stimulate growth and learning is that they require us to use a lot of different modes of perception and cognition. So that is ways of experiencing the world, different ways of thinking about objects or thinking about ideas. Now, the more you use these different skills, the better you get at them. So you could probably feel a bit like a video game character rounding out a skill set. Now, you know, the more you develop a skill, practice it on, you know, those monsters, you develop strength, agility, stamina, magic, and so on. This idea of skill development, you know, in multiple different modes of cognition, modes of thinking, modes of doing, draws on our earlier example about the neurons. So for example, with me, in my episode in the mountains, there was a set of connecting neurons that addressed, say, balance, you know, help me keep my balance on those sleek rocks. And I also required some degree of physical strength and endurance to reach that ridge. Mental strength, imagination, and interior discipline, positive reinforcement, these were all necessary as well to envision that path and stick to it. I also needed map reading skills and technological capabilities to navigate myself to safety, but of course I also needed visual spatial awareness. Sometimes the map would be off, and I'd need to rediscover the path when it was lost. So there are so many different things that come into even just one problem. And of course, problems are more complex the more factors that you add in. So we're going to segue now into the book section of this episode. In this book section, we're going to look at the mythological and literary perspectives on why challenges seem to be such an invigorating way to learn, or such an important way for us to learn and grow in resilience. And so for this section, we're going to draw on mostly the work of a comparative mythologist, called Joseph Campbell. Comparative mythologist, you might be wondering, what the heck is that? A mythologist is somebody who studies myths, and if they are comparative, then they're studying across different traditions or across different myths. So they're not just an expert in one area, but they're looking for patterns or similarities, but also differences across different storytelling traditions or different myths. So Joseph Campbell is a comparative mythologist. He's copped a little bit of flack for being a bit too generalizing, some people might say, but he is definitely one of the pioneers of this concept of the hero's journey. And when I say is, I mean, in a sense, was, because he was writing from about the 1950s to the 1980s. So he's since passed away, but this most important work that he wrote on the hero's journey, the thing that started it all, was written in the 1950s. Now, have any of you heard of this concept of the hero's journey before? Maybe, maybe not. But if you've ever seen a Disney film, read a Harry Potter, or watched Star Wars, you might be familiar with some of these concepts. In fact, George Lucas, Star Wars, he based the storyline of A New Hope off the work of Joseph Campbell, off the hero's journey. But that doesn't really matter anyway, because Harry Potter is better than Star Wars. Probably just put my foot in it there for some of you, but moving on. Joseph Campbell studied many of the world's myths, like Homer's The Odyssey, The Iliad, The Epic of Gilgamesh that was written in now what's modern-day Iraq 4,000 years ago, and many more. And he discovered some key archetypes, so types, literally, of characters that recur throughout these types of stories. So some common archetypes include the guide, overprotective mother, the tempter, the temptress, the monster. Now, here's the general shape of the hero's journey. You have an inexperienced protagonist, you know, the hero, living in a rather sheltered community. And then, one day, they hear the call to adventure. A problem arises, or a guide arrives who reveals the existence of this much wider world, a more dangerous world. The hero is thrust into this world on some kind of quest, you know, overcoming problems like deceit or attacks by monsters. Ultimately, they are led to the darkest point of their journey, which in some cases is literally the underworld, as in the Odyssey. And it's at this point that a part of them dies. Perhaps it's a part of their character, you know, like an immaturity or dependence on others, and then they are reborn or transformed and they become more independent. This is then the point at which they atone for their past wrongdoings or their past immaturity, let's say. They may have wronged certain characters throughout their journey, and now they continue to develop the fullness of their character. The hero, at this point, they're a changed person, you know, perhaps physically, but certainly within, in the spiritual, emotional, or intellectual sense. They return to their community at the end of their adventure. They help their community to flourish by passing on that hard-won wisdom and perspective of that dangerous world out there. And this is a big responsibility. You'd better hope the hero paid attention and learned when they're in the midst of their trials, or they undergot their fight in the monster. You know, they better be paying attention. How are they going to kill that monster? Because in the future, their community may not be able to depend on other helpers, you know, the way the hero did on their journey. They had the guide, they had other people to help them. The community may not be able to depend on those kind of things. They may not even be able to depend on the hero themselves that's there, that has all the wisdom, you know. You've got to transfer that knowledge as effectively as you can to help people, because you never know when they're going to have to do it independently, whenever they have to face a dragon independently. So Joseph Campbell, he does have some critics. You know, some people think that the hero's journey, it's too general, it's too popular. Well, some people say, you know, it's the hero's journey, but where's the heroine? You know, where's the lady? But from my readings of the myths themselves, I can assure you there is something universal here. For who doesn't have the help of a guide in these situations? Who doesn't seek to grow in independence and face dark, troubling moments that ultimately show us the resilience that we never knew we had? This is life. You know, this is education. It's learning. It's overcoming problems. It's learning about our own deeper capacities that we can always continue to apply, continue to grow in. Now, here's another consideration. Some of us may not be very community-minded in the traditional sense. We may not all gather in the local hall over biscuits. We may not even know where to find our community, you know, the local community. Where are they? You know, are they at the shopping center? I don't know. But our communities are everywhere, especially today. You know, that could be in our classes, shopping centers, workplaces, friendships, families, online, you name it. There are a lot of different communities. You're probably a part of many different communities and not just one. Now, I have some questions for you to consider based on this idea of the hero's journey. If you have one thing that you could teach to one community in your life, what would it be? Who are the guides in your life? If you don't have any, where could you go to find them? What is the monster that you need to overcome? What weapons, skills, or secret advantages do you have to help you win this fight? Which communities most often bring out that call to adventure in you? In a sense, you're part of my community, and if I had one thing to teach you, it would be don't be reckless like I was in some of my adventures. To sum up, in this episode, we tackled the question of why we learn by overcoming challenges. Cognitive conflict in the face of challenges, we discussed, revealed that need for collaboration, reflection, and different ways of viewing the world. All of these can be applied again in new contexts. That's metacognition. From the hero's journey, we learned that overcoming challenges stimulates learning because you have to learn. In the extreme cases, it's to survive, but it's always due to the commitment to share what one learns with one's community, so that they may not suffer, you know, that gripping ordeal of the problem itself. You can spare them that, teach them the ways so that they can apply them, you know, less intense, less demanding circumstances. Now, is there a sense in which we should learn this way? You know, I'm not to be the judge, potentially, here, you know, but problems may give us some of the best preparation we have for the difficulties of life, which are themselves problems. And overcoming them can give us a great sense of joy, great sense of reward when we successfully navigate them. I'd like to finish with a final reflection on what I learned during my encounter with the Korean mountain. I've thought back to this experience a few times in the months since when I've been confronted with a stressful situation. It could be a Year 9 English class that descended into chaos, or a few job interviews, or making the decision to say goodbye to my canine companion in 17 years. For example, I'd be plucking a bit of dust off my suit before the job interview and think, at least it's dust and not mud from an East Asian mountain. And it's so fascinating how my mind actually feels the same way when I'm in these stressful scenarios. Like, it's aware of all the ways that the situation could go wrong, but, you know, like in the mountains, it doesn't dive into them, obsess about them, exaggerate all these different risks, and then get bogged down. Instead, it acknowledges the risks and then takes steps to make the negative outcomes of those risks as unlikely as possible. But of course, you know, they're always simmering there beneath the surface of my awareness. But all I can do is physically just be there and get through step by step. Doesn't matter what it is, you know, is it a hike, is it a job interview, is it some kind of stressful class, whatever kind of stressful situation it is. And I suppose my mind feeling that same kind of way, that's got to hark back to the cognitive conflict, the neural networks that we discussed linked with concentration, risk assessment, and so on. All the different pathways, patterns, skill trees of neural networks in my head, they're probably engaged in all the same ways in all these different situations. But I'm not a neurologist or a neuroscientist or anything like that. The final thing I learned is a bit of humility. And that's not to say I should berate myself for being a drama queen by worrying about a job interview when I've been through something worse. You know, like, shut up and be grateful, okay, because you've been through something worse. But don't put yourself down at the same time. I'm sure there are other situations in my life, or definitely in other people's lives, but for me, maybe 1 year away, 7 years, 13 years away, that could dwarf that mountain. I shouldn't make out like that's the biggest, toughest thing I've gone through, you know, like a badge of honor. I've heard of people only a few years older than me that died from a brain tumor, or lost family members and friends to suicide. It's terrible, terrible things that, you know, I pray that never actually happened to me. But you think, wow, you know, just keep on plugging away, pray that those things don't happen to me, but be glad of whatever the degree of challenge is for whatever I've been through. Just be glad, be humble that I'm on some kind of path now, and hoping to feel invigorated and cherishing that continual growth through challenges in my own life. Thank you all so much for joining me here today and for engaging in conversations with me. You really helped to nourish my thinking and influence the topics that I explore here. It's fantastic, so thank you so much. Also, if you've subscribed to the show, thank you, you're a legend, and if you haven't done so, get onto it. You can be a legend as well. Thank you so much. Or if you'd like to hear about some upcoming shows through other channels, you can do that by email. You can do that by Facebook. As a nice little bonus as well, there are extra videos, things that I've created, or things that I refer to elsewhere, which you can find by doing that. So hit that up as well. That would be great. False Summits partly owes its existence to Claire Fogarty and Michael Zampogna, two stalwart creatives and longtime friends. A huge thank you to Claire for her music production, and to Michael for the uplifting design that you see before you on your screen. Alright everyone, that's it from me for today for this episode. I'll see you next time. Take care.